Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, the Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning appointment, please call 919-779-1755. This program is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Both of today's trivia questions come to us from Uncle John's Bathroom Reader, Plunges into Music. Question number one, what is the meaning of the term spaghetti western? Is that A, it's a recommended meal to eat while watching John Wayne movies? Is it B, it's a cowboy comedy movie, usually involving at least one food fight? Is it C, it's a genre of music written by Italian composers as a film score? Or is it D, it's a westernized twist to an Asian recipe for baked lo mein noodles? So, spaghetti western? What is that, anyway? And question number two, what was the name of the fictional foursome band starring actor George Clooney, featured in the 2000 film O Brother, Where Art Thou, that traveled throughout the South singing their hit song, Man of Constant Sorrow? Was that A, the Foggy Mountain Boys, B, the Soggy Bottom Boys, C, the Catty Crooked Boys, or D, the Dodgy Donkey Boys? So, brother, where art thou, anyway? The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from the website onthatday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of July the 19th. Well, it was on this very day back in 1966 that singer Frank Sinatra, at the age of 50, married 20-year-old actress Mia Farrow. 1966 today. And it was 34 years ago today, 1990, that singer Vicky Carr opened the ceremonies for the dedication of the Nixon Library. She sang in front of four presidents, President Nixon, President Ford, President Reagan, and President Bush, all which she had performed for at the White House during their terms. Henry Kissinger, Alexander Haig, and Gene Autry were also present. 1990 today. Beethoven introduces our classical music news. It's titled, Curious Cat Wanders on Stage During Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony in Istanbul. This cat has impeccable musical taste. This is published on June the 3rd, 2024 in ClassicFM.com. Maddie Shaw Roberts. At the 52nd Istanbul Music Festival, the music sounded so good that this feline visitor simply had to go and investigate. Her interest, piqued perhaps by the rural theme, a stray cat elegantly glided in from stage left during an exquisite performance of Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony No. 6 by the Lucerne Festival Strings. The musicians of the illustrious Switzerland-based chamber orchestra smiled knowingly as they spotted the cat prowling onto the concert stage. After pausing for a moment to observe the music, the four-legged fan hastened to move across the stage as the first violins took the swelling melody. Tail flying, she soon wandered off again confidently, stage right, as if completely accustomed to life on the stage. In the second half of the Beethoven concert, which was given on Friday, 31 May, the Lucerne Festival Strings were joined by a pianist for a performance of the Great Piano Concerto No. 3. "He's obviously the guest conductor, so show him some respect," one commenter dryly remarked on Instagram, where the video was posted. The clip of the music-loving cat has gone viral on social media, with over 8 million views in the last 2 days from people across the world enjoying the amusing moment. Another viewer commented, "The cat knowing exactly that it's the center of attention, because who even cares about those amazing musicians working all day long to produce those angelic sounds when there's a cute kitty?" Apparently, the cat is a regular attendee at the International Convention and Exhibition Center and has gone viral in the past. Bravo to the Lucerne Festival Strings for a sublime moment of music making, enjoyed, quite understandably, by audiences of the two- and four-legged variety. Duke Ellington, Take the A-Train, introduces our jazz music news. It's titled Jazz Remains the Sound of Modernism. This is published on June 19, 2024, in themillions.com by Ed Simon. Always he appeared immaculate, always elegant. When Duke Ellington took the stage at Carnegie Hall in January of 1943 for the premiere of his Black, Brown, and Beige Symphony, it was in white tie and tailed black tuxedo. Fastidious as a musician and uncompromising as a band leader, Ellington expected nothing less than polish when it came to his appearance and comportment, especially as the United States' greatest composer making his debut in its greatest concert hall at the belated age of 43. Ellington was perhaps most responsible for extending jazz's reach beyond juke joints and uptown clubs, of establishing it as what the trumpeter Wynton Marsalis has termed America's classical music. European classical music influenced by jazz has been played here before, George Gershwin, Dmitri Shostakovich, but nothing quite of the magnitude of Ellington's new composition, molding the syncopated sound of American jazz into the movements of European symphonic music. Ellington desired, quote-unquote, "an authentic record of my race written by a member of it." By the time he took the stage at Carnegie Hall, Ellington was already either the composer or consummate performer of jazz standards like "It Don't Mean a Thing If It Ain't Got That Swing" or "Take the A-Train," the song playing in the background now, a music that conveyed American modernism. the sonic equivalent of a William Carlos Williams poem or a Jackson Pollock painting, compositions that were to music what the Chrysler Building is to architecture. My own introduction to jazz was because of my father, a college chemistry professor, but also a saxophonist and clarinetist who was a lifetime member of the American Federation of Musicians and played with drummers that had performed with Louis Armstrong and guitarist who knew Dizzy Gillespie. He worked his way through college and graduate school by both laboring in the same machine shop as his father and playing gigs with his combo, the Crescendos, throughout eastern Pennsylvania. When I was growing up, he would tell me stories about trips to New York to see live music at Birdland or the Village Vanguard, and then getting back to reading just as dawn broke before his classes. Grading papers in his small home office, he'd spend hours listening to Pittsburgh's WDUQ, parsing the intricacies of an improvised Dexter Gordon sax solo, or the time signature in an Ahmad Jamal piano composition. Because of my dad, I first heard not just Ellington and Armstrong, but the rough velvet of Billie Holiday's voice and the vermouth smoothness of Ella Fitzgerald. The incomparably cool trumpet of Miles Davis on Kinda Blue, and the ecstatic, sacred keening of John Coltrane's alto sax on A Love Supreme. The blessed quantum cacophony of Charlie Parker's saxophone on The Bird, and the jittery, puffed-cheek caffeination of Gillespie's trumpet solo from Salt Peanuts. The mathematical precision of Dave Brubeck's piano from Time Out, and the transcendence of Thelonious Monk. Charlie Mingus's strangely raucous bass, and Art Blakey with his jazz messengers pounding out the avant-garde drum. And throughout it all, no matter how sophisticated or complicated, how abstract or difficult, that human message which Nina Simone sung out in her deep, wide, prophetic voice. The world is big, big and bright and round, and it's full of folks like me. Born from the main branch of the 12-bar blues, also the progenitor of soul and rock, funk and hip-hop, jazz was first an amalgamation of ragtime and spirituals, marching band music, and Dixieland, performed in democratic collaboration and mediated through the still remarkably experimental method of improvisation. This is the potted history that sees jazz as a melange of Africa and Europe. America is a land of synthesis in which every ethnic or religious group tends over time to become a part of every other, writes critic Stanley Crouch in Considering Jazz, Writings on Genius. Despite Crouch's tendency to smooth over jazz history so as to make it palatable to his own pet theories, there's much that's factual here. It's true that no nation other than the U.S. could have created jazz for the simple reason that the historical traumas and ruptures that brought disparate groups together happened most acutely here. If jazz is the sound of modernism, it's because it was born from the fertile but bloody soil of the American continent. In this context, the Vivaldi of jazz was Armstrong, which is to say the genius at the beginning of the genre, but Ellington was its Bach, the polymath who supplied a rigor that most fully marks before and after. At Ellington's Carnegie Hall debut, where audiences listened to weekly concerts of Bach and Beethoven, Mozart and Mahler, Ellington and his musicians performed a 45-minute symphony dedicated to Black America, expressing the history of his people from enslavement to emancipation, the talent and tents of the Harlem Renaissance, and into the future. The music itself is as uncompromising as Ellington, relentlessly forward-pushing and soaring, grounded in history and hopeful. The shape is classical, but the sound is jazz. The critics, classist, racist, were not effusive. Duke, with his slick back hair and pencil-thin mustache simply responded to the pans by saying, well, I guess they didn't dig it. Ellington would perform 20 more times at Carnegie Hall until a few years before his death, and he'd repurpose large portions of Black, Brown, and Beige in a 1958 collaboration with Mahalia Jackson, but he'd never again conduct the entirety of the symphony. The article skips down and ends with this. Jazz is an American sound, an African sound, but it is also a modern sound, a modernist sound. Alfred Apple Jr. argues in his study, Jazz Modernism, from Ellington and Armstrong to Matisse and Joyce, that to call jazz musicians modernists is to appreciate their procedures as alchemists of the vernacular who have, quote-unquote, jazzed the ordinary and given it new life. Armstrong and Ellington, Coltrane and Davis, Gillespie and Parker were central to the same project as other modernists. They reconfigured time and space to craft an alternative way of expression. When asked what jazz is, Satchmo answered, if you have to ask, you'll never know. And that seems the best rejoinder to critics. Millennia hence, when the survivors of what we've done live in a temperate rim at the top and bottom of the world, I imagine that there will be people who listen to Satchmo, Train, Bird, and Duke, that those names will endure, those melodies and rhythms will be remembered by someone, still allowing for us to slip into the breaks and look around. Jim Morrison and the Doors introduces our rock and pop music news. It's titled 27 Club. Famous musicians, artists, and actors dead at 27. What is the 27 Club? This is published in playback.fm. If you're a music fan, you've probably heard mention here and there of the 27 Club, a term that gets thrown around so casually that it seems everybody is expected to know what it is. Dating back to the 90s as a result of the death of Kurt Cobain, the phrase 27 Club refers to one of pop culture's most tragic and unusual coincidences, the fact that an abnormally high number of celebrities, particularly rock and roll musicians, have died at the young age of 27. Most often causes of death of 27 Club musicians have been related to lifestyle choices associated with rock and roll, like drug and alcohol addiction. However, several notable deaths, like that of Cobain, were from violent causes, like murder and freak accidents. In fact, it was Cobain's death that led to people really connecting the dots about the number 27. Which at that point also applied to the deaths of Brian Jones, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, and Jim Morrison, all of which happened in the four-year span between 1969 and 1971. Today, the 27 Club is a well-known concept in pop culture, with a multitude of references made to it in the press, music, movies, exhibitions, novels, and plays. Perhaps the main reason the club so captures the attention of the public is that it points to grim realities of what a career in the public eye can lead to, emphasizing that there is a darker side to the otherwise glorified lifestyles of the rich and famous. Twenty-seven club members. While some sources number the membership of the 27 club at over 70 people, there are some members who are considered most notable, being referenced each time the club is mentioned. Here are a few of them. One of the most celebrated guitarists and musicians at the time, Jimi Hendrix, was perhaps the most influential figure in the 1960s rock and roll scene in America. Known for headlining the famous 1969 Woodstock Festival, being the world's highest paid performer at the time, and pioneering the use of feedback and distortion in guitar playing, Hendrix passed away from barbiturate-related asphyxia in 1970 after taking 18 times the recommended dosage of sleeping tablets. Another of the most well-known rock stars of the 60s who performed at Woodstock in 69, Janis Joplin's powerful vocals and electric stage presence remain immortalized as some of the most iconic recordings and performances in popular music history. Joplin was known to be a drug user and died in 1970 of a heroin overdose, possibly compounded by alcohol. Lead vocalist of the acclaimed rock band The Doors, Jim Morrison, playing in the background now, has gone down in history as one of rock music's most iconic frontmen. Representing countercultural rebellion with his poetic lyrics and erratic behavior. However, a large part of Morrison's mythical career was alcoholism, which may have been related to his death in Paris in 1971. Because France did not require autopsies, Morrison's cause of death remains unknown, though both heart failure and heroin overdose are cited as possible causes. So, how'd you do on today's trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, what is the meaning of the term spaghetti western? Is it A, it's a recommended meal to be eaten while watching John Wayne movies? Is it B, it's a cowboy comedy movie, usually involving at least one food fight? Is it C, it's a genre of music written by Italian composers as a film score? Or is it D, it's a westernized twist to an Asian recipe for baked lo mein noodles? Correct answer? Answer C. As noted in the book Uncle John's Bathroom Reader Plunges into Music, Ennio Morricone, an Italian composer born in 1928, almost single-handedly invented this genre of film scoring. All you have to do is think of Clint Eastwood. In his early Western phase, hear that music? That plaintive whistling, banging, shouting, ringing, and the twangy electric guitar? That's Italo Western music, as it's sometimes called. Morricone first created it in 1964 when he began his famous collaboration with director Sergio Leone on his film A Fistful of Dollars. He went on to develop the sound in more than 30 Westerns, and hundreds of other directors were influenced by his work. In the years since, bands all over the world, like Tokyo's Los Rancheros, Norway's Los Plantonics and Germany's Motor Psychos have made the sound part of their act. Uncle John's bathroom reader recommends the album For a Few Guitars More, a tribute to Morricone's spaghetti western themes. And the answer to our second question, what was the name of the fictional foursome band starring actor George Clooney, featured in the 2000 film O Brother, Where Art Thou, that traveled throughout the South singing their hit song, Man of Constant Sorrow? Were they A, the Foggy Mountain Boys, B, the Soggy Bottom Boys, C, the Cagey Crooked Boys, or D, the Dodgy Donkey Boys? Correct answer? Answer B, the Soggy Bottom Boys, is the name of the band featured in the 2000 film O Brother, Where Art Thou, starring George Clooney. The song they recorded with the blind DJ was Man of Constant Sorrow, written by American songwriter Dick Burnett in 1913. The name of the band pokes fun at the real band, the Foggy Mountain Boys. The fictional Soggy Mountain Boys and the great music in that film were such a hit that Dan Tominski and the other musicians who played on the soundtrack toured to support the album. The film's version of Man of Constant Sorrow, sung by Tominski, won the 2001 Grammy for Best Country Collaboration with Vocals. So, let's close out today's program with the inventor of Italo Western music. Here's Morricone's Gabriel's Oboe. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. This program is also available as a podcast after the broadcast in our website, ncreadingservice.org. As we leave you now, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. If you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me at 919-832-5138. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Music Review, underwritten by Bill McClure. Tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning, please call 919-779-1755. So long, until next time.